This is KHBR, the voice of darkness for the intrepid travelers of the left-hand path. I'm Magister Robert Adams, your host. We'll be accompanying you on your journey. So get ready, sit back, relax, and prepare to kefir and remanifest. Welcome to KHBR, the voice of darkness. I'm Magister Robert Adams, your host. And today we are presenting a lecture given by Dr. Stephen Flowers on the concept of runa and how it applies to one's initiation. I hope that you enjoy this lecture and gain something from it. Dr. Flowers has published over 20 books on the subject of runa and related subjects, and in 1980 founded the Rune Guild, the world's largest and most influential initiatory organization dedicated to rune work and the Odin path.
Today I would like to talk to you about runa. 20 years after, it was 10 years ago that the word matured, I would say, to the level that I'm satisfied with. People often remarked that I had quite a long period between the recognition of the word runa and my taking of the degree of the sixth. And it has to do with the dynamism of the nature of this particular word. It's when do you say something that is so dynamic is finished or is completed? And after 20 years now, I can say that I had to come to the conclusion that it's the nature of the word that it be so dynamic that I would never get that feeling. I would never get that. And that is the nature of the word in its completed form, that it's pulling me on now. It's pulling me onward. And anyone who has sincerely sought this mystery will have the same experience. Rune, I think, began for me. And I write about this in my History of the Rune Guild, it's called, but really it's a lot of it is a memoir of various facets of my life. And early on in there, I talk about when I was, 5 years old. And one night, I and my parents were in the backyard of our house in a little town in Texas, and we looked up into the sky, and we saw an unbelievable, remarkable phenomenon. It is called an occultation of a star by the moon. And this star, Venus, it was not a star, it was a planet, Venus, appeared to be caught on the horn of a crescent moon. And it looked like an explosion was occurring on the moon. Accounts of it in the paper the next day, which I have reproduced in an appendix in this Rune Guild history, have it that this was in 1958, I think, and Cold War times, and people thought the Russians had exploded an A-bomb on the moon. That was the kind of thing that people were reporting. Or are we being attacked from another planet or whatever? But it was astounding to anyone who saw it. And it has a picture of it, a little photograph, which doesn't do the actual experience justice. But nevertheless, it's there. And I remember that vividly. Can smell the cool air of that night even now. And the experience, I think, was the first manifestation of runa in my life. And that is the beginning where we see something that's mysterious. We don't understand. I'm a five-year-old kid, curiously and interestingly, in this thing that this article that my mother cut out of the paper and kept, luckily, so I actually have it. At that time, I wrote my name, Stevie, underneath this photograph. I think one of the letters is backwards. I was really illiterate, but it kind of, well, I wasn't, you know. They told my parents, said, don't teach him how to read, just let us do that, you know. But I was still trying. But so I identified somehow with it. I wrote my name under there. And so it was the beginning of mystery and the mysterious manifestation for me. And probably some other people too, maybe. But that's where it really began for me. So, of course, most people, or a lot of people, maybe a lot of people here, haven't heard the story of how I heard the word. Because I think you really have to hear a word before you can utter it. Or at least some words. Or I'll say at least runa. I heard it before I spoke it. Which is true, probably most words, mundane or otherwise. I will confess here now, before you all, an occultic nincompoop. Okay. Before I became the all-wise being you see now, I was an occultic nincompoop, believing in everything from Bigfoot to the comet Kahutek. You know, that was a big one back then. So I would go to a psychic shows or whatever. Went to one in Dallas one time. And there was this guy on stage named Norbu Chin. And he was a Tibetan. Well, he was an American guy, but he'd gone to Tibet, you see. And he had learned all the secrets of the Tibetan masters, like how to pass a pin through a balloon, for example, and other things that I'm sure the Dalai Lama indulges in on a regular basis. But he was doing this, and then this, so I'm saying, okay, that's fantastic. And so this Wiccan priestess rounds us up, me and another person, and rounds us up to go, we're going to go meet this guy. I found out where he lives, so we're going to go down there. So, okay, road trip, I'm up for it. And so there I go down there to see this person. And she goes up to, well, we pull up in front of his house, and it turns out it's like a trailer with like muscle cars up on blocks and stuff. It really didn't look like a Tibetan monastery to me, but you know, who am I to say really what, you know. So she knocks on the door, and he comes out, and he had some domestic brew in his hand, and his t-shirt didn't quite cover his stomach. I remember that part. But she came back to the car quickly and said, he's not ready to meet with us yet. And we sped off before he went and got the gun, I'm sure, you know, or the big needle, maybe, you know, he'd come after us. So I'm sitting in the car saying, well, that was weird. And I'm just sitting there in the back of the car, and it was the summertime, and it was hot, and this jalopy had no air conditioning. And all of that. And so I was sitting there just sort of dozing in the back seat. And then this word, this audible word comes, runa. So what's that? That's it. That's all it was. Luckily, I was enrolled at the University of Texas, not making much use of my time there up to that point. But had one of the world's best academic libraries right there the next day. Skip all classes, go to library, look up runes. I knew runa had something to do with runes. I knew something roughly about it, but nothing more than the average occultist nincompoop of the day. And so I checked out all these books. And there was an occult book in there, a German occult book. Luckily also I knew German well enough to read this kind of thing at that time. And then there was all this scholarly stuff. So from that stack of stuff that came down, in those days you couldn't go into the stacks of the library at the university. You just ordered the books, they came down in a big stack, and you took them away. So there's this pile, so work on it, synthesize it, and that's where it started. That was in like 1974. But that wasn't what we're talking about as Sedians, as a word. I mean, it's 100,000 people could have had that kind of experience, but only with the training, tutelage, influence of Dr. Aquino was I able to focus this experience and this work that I had done up to that point in the kind of way that it had, in the way that it has become what it is. Otherwise, it would have never been focused and given the kind of philosophical consistency and velocity that it received. And so it was in 1989, on July 13th, is when the recognition was actually formally done, although I think my certificate says North Solstice on it. But that's just, you know, Dr. Aquino's kind of way of ritualizing it. But it was actually the date, as some of you know, is quite significant in and of itself. July 13th. I think that's it has a number of meanings on its own, mysterious meanings and mundane. So it's been 20 years since that happened. And what has happened? What is that thing? What is that first experience of seeing that planet hanging on the moon, the hearing of the word, that utterance? Well, I believe that the hearing came from a higher source, from a God, a specific God most of you know the name of. And that, as I oftentimes say, so opposed to the Ramtha fans out there or whatever, the channel beings from another planet, and the God or this creature from wherever dictates a book above about 1,000 pages to them, and this book basically says the same thing that Madame Blavatsky said, that if a God really speaks to you, one word's enough, at least for one at least for one lifetime, you know. I mean, because I've taken this one thing, this one experience, simple. So that doesn't make, I mean, I try to make it into a good story, but it's really not that good a story. You know, a cultist word, nincompoop, hears word, starts off on a journey. But this word, that's why I use the word in the description, unfoldment, that the word, something like that, a philosophical concept, is this one thing. It seems small, but you start unfolding it, you start working it, it just keeps unfolding and unfolding and meaning. And what a lot of people here come up to me and say, well, I read your book here, and I did that, and I saw that, and I had some kind of, my work has made an impact on people's initiation, and I haven't met them till now. And it's been gratifying to meet with people who said, I started out reading Lords of the Left-Hand Path or whatever. And in a magical sense, these books, these works, are edges of the planes of the opening or the unfoldment of this flower, this petal, this thing, which is Runa. And so when you read that, to me, this is the way I think of my written work and that sort of thing, is that it is mysteriously, in places unknown, as it unfolds, people are riding that, the edges of those planes and angles as it opens up, and receiving different forms of information specific and peculiar to them at their time and place. And that's part of the reason why, well, I'm referred to often as, well, he's prolific, he writes a lot. He writes too much. We can't keep up with all this stuff. And it's just like a little bit of that. Here he's over here with the talking about the Freemasons. The next thing you know, he's hermetic, and it's the runes. And now here's the one on this. But the thing that holds it all together is there's one thing I'm talking about, and one thing only, and that is, by whatever name you want to call it, runa, mysterion, or whatever, the idea that there is something hidden from us. In the everyday part of our lives, we say, we confront life and say, okay, this is what it appears to be, but what's hidden? What's not apparent? What's not obvious? What's mysterious? Most of the time, a lot of colleagues I have in the field of scientific runology look at runes themselves, the ancient runic inscription. So there's nothing mysterious about them. They're just scratchings of our barbaric ancestors, etc. And they can't see even the fact that they read and they write themselves. They've lost all sense of mystery about the wonders of the human mind, spirit, and soul that is able to do this act at any time, any place. Their sense of mystery is virtually dead. And they have their reasons for saying that or taking that attitude, but they cannot see it. They cannot see the mystery. They cannot see, they have no sense of mystery or the unknown about it. And that's their approach to life in general. You know, what's obvious is true. What people say is true is obviously true. And here at the university or here in this country or wherever. And the principle of Runa is counter that, says what is unknown at every moment of life. If you can discipline yourself enough to approach a period, even a minutes, hours, whatever, looking at life in that way, it can be revealing. And for most people, I wouldn't suggest going too far with that. But at a time, you know, it's like something. Because really, the big questions are more what we're interested in addressing rather than small things. Although, a good detective, homicide detective, or whatever, is applying the same concepts of unraveling the truth that's hidden from them. Of course, I talk about the ancient ancestors of Germanic people. I had two words for secret. One is one that is an eternal mystery that is from beyond. It is from the gods. It is from outside of humanity, and that's the word runa, rune. And then there's another word in Icelandic, leyndomr, that just means like something which is concealed. Somebody is hiding something from you, is lying to you, is keeping something secret from you conventionally. So there's this semiotically, there's these two different concepts about what a secret is, an eternal mystery or somebody just hiding the facts from you intentionally, different things. But finding out what's behind it is a similar thing. You assume you don't know. You assume ignorance. Is all wisdom, all knowledge begins with an assumption of ignorance. That's one thing the occultozoid nincompoop doesn't understand. They always assume that from the first, before they even read their first, you know, Llewellyn book, they think, I already know everything. I'm just looking for some framework to bolster my beliefs and opinions. But I already know what's important and what's real and what's necessary. I'm just looking for books that say that thing to me. And so they already know. There's not an assumption of ignorance. There's an assumption that they already know everything. And no one becomes smart that way. Not really. Just like no one becomes strong by assuming they're strong like a little 5-year-old boy. Say, I'm Superman. He'll probably never pick up a weight, you know, never do any exercise because he's already Superman. What do you want? You know, he's already made it. What can I do from there? I have no work to do. So I'll just associate with people who say I am Superman, and that I won't go anywhere where it's believed I'm not Superman. And I'll read books that reinforce this idea to me. So that's the world of occultozoid nincompoopery and a lot of other problems in society, but since this is sort of the idiom we're speaking in here. But Runa says the opposite. Says, like I told that story about how I learned to write in a day when the professor said, flowers, you can't write worth shit. Okay? Well, suddenly I got a whole lot better overnight. But that was kind of room network. You put this words to paper, and you thought I turned it in and said, "Look how smart I am, Professor. You're a dumbass," is the answer. You know, it's like, uh-oh, well, now see, Runa at work in life says, you're not, it's what you thought, what you believed, what was apparent to you at the moment you turned it in is untrue. And you need to seek within or without, or you need to do some work in order to correct that. So it's not, my experience of this is that it's in big things and small things, it made manifest and unfolds that way. And over the years, I've used this, you could call it a method, people have referred to or shown it, I've referred to and spoken about it as the Polarian method, wherein you combine rational with supra-rational things, with experience, applying knowledge to practical or everyday situations or philosophical situations, not just allowing them to just be facts and figures and stuff that just floats around in your head intellectually so that you can impress somebody at an academic cocktail party about what you know. But rather, what have you applied? Well, how have you used it? How have you made your life or the life of others better with this information or knowledge? And, of course, putting it out in the world. I was on a trajectory in my world, my beliefs. I said, okay, I'm getting this PhD. I'm going to go teach Germanic studies and do this kind of thing at a university somewhere and do this other stuff on the side. Culture changes, so we don't want any of this Germanic stuff in our universities anymore, this old stuff. So you're on your own. No, okay. So that's how something like Runa Raven is born. But I again see, as I call it, you know, the hand of the old man at work. Says, we got enough professors. What we need is somebody to do this thing, this other thing. And so something like what has become a business with Runa Raven is kind of like my objective universe scorecard. It's like, here it is working in the world. How successful is it? It's a success not just of selling books, but also of the ideas. And of course, I rarely get any feedback except in a gathering like this and a few others, where somebody says, "I've read this and I have used this," and it is, in other words, working in a way beyond just, okay, people are buying these books and that's it. That's all I know. They could be, you know, using them for kindling for all I know. When it gets cold up in the in Alaska somewhere. So that is something that I have been fortunate enough to be able to do with the work of the word Runa, is turn it into something which is active in the world, and not something which is something that I just contemplate philosophically and share with only a few people. And I feel that that has sharpened my understanding, my own understanding, and my application of this word and why it's unfolded the way it has. Now, fundamental to the notion of Runa is the idea of inquiry, of asking questions. And if people have heard my talks, my Woodharrow lectures, which are, you know, on Woodharrow website, woodharrow.com, or Radio Free Runa talks that I do on edred.net and places like that, know that I can prattle on like no one probably you've heard before. And I usually put most people's butts dead to sleep before it's over with, okay? The Wood Herald talks, they just sit there for 2 hours. Sometimes I forget to give them a break or anything. I just get so involved. So, but this is a different group. This is a group of the elect. This is a group of the children of Set, And I am going to now entertain questions, which is something I usually don't do. Waldo can attest to this, Adept Thompson. He has seen me quite a bit. He said, rarely do I allow people to question me. But you aren't people, are you? You're all gods and goddesses. So, anybody have any questions? I will repeat the questions so this microphone doesn't pick things up. Or I'll summarize them. Yes.
Maybe clarify a little bit about the difference between pursuing mysteries in the sense of Bruno and Mysterion and what people in the occult do, since you have referred to that, how Runa leads to clarity because it has a method, a self-correcting method, a reality-based method.
Okay.
And contrast that with with occultism.
Yeah. I think that Runa, although it says it's the unknown, and it could be translated as the occult, the question is, what is the difference between occultism and the runic, and Runa and the runic method, basically? And I think it boils down to that distinction of an assumption, an actual open inquiry, and assuming that things are unknown, and that my answer will not be something I already know. It's rather like the idea of initiation, wherein someone says, oh, I want to get involved in magic, and I want to become whatever kind of a person, and so forth. And you ask, well, how will you be when you're finished? And I say, well, I'll be this, and I'll be that, and I'll have this characteristic, and I'll be this way and that. So, well, you already know that now, don't you? So what are you doing all this for? You're already there. You already have that knowledge. You're not becoming something you aren't, yet you are not already aware of. So the occultizoid nincompoop always just sort of takes his cue from someone else and says, this is what I should be. It's a predetermined. It's rather like Christian philosophy. It's not true philosophy. It's using the accoutrements of philosophy to prove an already established belief, rather than saying, I'm going to start on this method. I'm going to use these methods of inquiry, and the answer is unknown at this point.
So the reasoning is circular.
Yeah, because we already know what the conclusion is, or in right-hand path religion or a lot of other things.
Mark. I have some of your writings.
Refer
to the school of nine angles.
Right.
As the school of men itself. Could you maybe speak a bit on the relationship between your explorations of the internet and your use of that?
Oh, I'd love to. That's probably it for the thing. But when I joined the temple, one of the main things, and I think in this history of the Rune Guild, I know I have the first letter I wrote to the temple when I first applied. And I said, this is what I'm about, and this is what I have done, and kind of thing, and it's what I'm interested in. And it may be in there, but certainly it was in my mind. One of the things I wanted to unravel and learn is when I learned that, of course, Dr. Aquino wrote this ceremony of the nine angles in the satanic rituals. It was actually his work. And I knew that at that point, that I wanted to learn what are those things? What are the nine angles? What is the geometrical configuration of this? And through my work and it just wasn't something that he just, write to become a first degree, write to Michael Aquino and say, tell me about those nine angles, guy. It wasn't like that. I mean, I didn't do it that way. I mean, I wasn't going to do it that way. I was had the proper sense of awe, I'll put it that way, of the whole process. And so it was something I worked towards. And only after being in and actually, I think it's probably I was already at least a master in the order of the trapezoid, did I start to approach this kind of thing with him. And that is outlined in Order of the Trapezoid, the whole process in the documents of the order, how these nine angles is so referred in that working, how they were really abstract principles of number per se. And then I started to apply it on my own to this sigil or seal, first looking at the pentagram of Set, and then applying the trapezoid to it. And if you do that, you see that it creates this geometrical figure that was previously really unseen. And so then there you have the nine angles. And so then it became a process of unfathoming how, which angles are what, and what are their significance. So it was a whole process of unraveling this symbol, and ninefold or nine aspected geometrical figures have an ancient tradition. People are familiar with the Enneagram that made use of by Gurdjieff, which he claims to have gotten from Central Asian sources, of course. And in the Germanic tradition, there's the Wahlknutter, which is made up of three interlocked triangles, and so forth. So this is a personal fascination of mine. And so the principle of runa was applied, as I've talked about here already, about saying, well, I'm going to apply runa to this thing. I'm going to inquire. I'm going to ask. I'm going to work on things myself. I'm going to apply myself to understanding this. And there emerged this whole seal of runa configuration, which is not only philosophically interesting, dare I say enlightening, but also is useful from a magical perspective operatively. That basically there's a configuration of motion within this framework, and you'll notice in looking at that seal that the pentagram, of course, is separate from the world of nature, but it's connected to the trapezoid, and the trapezoid acts as a link between the subjective universe and the principle of isolate intelligence and the world of nature. A very handy link to have if you want to affect the world from consciousness. And so that the trapezoid does in this seal. But that it was a whole process over years, really, of coming to understand this symbol. And it's connected to a lot of other symbols also, but it's unique, never been sort of outlined in that way before. So, and it was sort of contemporary with the uttering and recognition of the word that all of this was happening. So, hence, Seal of Runa. Yes?
Mrs. Flowers, what is the relationship between Odin and Set?
Odin and Set, well, I'm an Indo-Europeanist, okay? I'm not an expert in what a lot of people here are experts in Egyptian ideas and so forth. But there is what Dr. Quino has written, that Set, this which, of course, we identify when I first joined the temple, we would talk about things like, you know, there's a sort of a danger of what was called creeping Neo-Egyptianism because of early manifestations of things in the temple. And that this was kind of a bad thing. Why was it a bad thing? Because it was all based on bad Egyptology. And subsequent work by Ipsissimus Webb and has corrected a lot of that. But there was not this sort of focus on that mythology per se, because what you had to understand is that Set is what? Is the principle of isolate consciousness or isolate intelligence, as I put it. And it is exemplified and illustrated in the pentagram of Set. That is our look at that. You can see the philosophy manifest. Okay, so principle of isolate intelligence. I see this, if you look at the Indo-European pantheon as going back to the origins of it, there were, in the highest levels of that pantheon, there are two gods. One, a god of sort of justice and law and order and that sort of thing. And these work together. They're not at odds with one another, really. And then one of consciousness, of inspiration and so forth. And when the creator of religion, a man by the name of Zarathustra, who created the first religion, and philosophy also, looked at this pantheon of which he was a priest and said, these gods are not critters, humanoid critters floating around in space, but are abstract principles. And there's this one God, the God of consciousness, which created all the other ones. And his name is Ahura Mazda, the wise Lord, the God of consciousness. And that same slot in the pantheon is filled by, in the Germanic tradition, by Odin, master of inspiration. So, master of inspiration, wise Lord, God of consciousness, principle of isolate intelligence. So, these are all just different names for the same thing culturally. I've written something which sort of, early on, I think it probably, I put it in Black Rune where I put everything, which is, you can get on a download now, and there's no books exist anymore of that. But, and it's in the archives of the temples in the somewhere. Who knows? You know, it's in the Order of the Trapezoid stuff. And, you know, speculating on that, but I don't believe what I wrote there anymore, that there is a distinction or a difference between Set and Odin, not philosophically. They are gods of consciousness. That answers the question that some people object to. Magister Fitzsimmons said, well, what do you disagree with in the, you know, Setian material? And a lot of times people will heavily disagree with the idea that Set created all the other gods. You know, that all the other gods are somehow unreal or whatever, that he created them, all the others, and he's the only real one. And of course, that doesn't make any sense in Egyptian world per se, if you're historically, but it makes sense from that philosophical perspective that the principle of isolate intelligence, need I go further, obviously created all the gods in our experience, because without, it's kind of like, what are gods without people, without consciousness incarnate in individual minds to contemplate the existence of the gods. It's like the tree falling in a forest. If no one's there to hear it, doesn't make a sound. Now, obviously, things are vibrated. Air moves. Something's happening. But is there the act of hearing? Does it occur? There's no ear there to hear. There's no receiver there to receive this activity. Then gods really don't exist. There's just existence, activity, etc. But who's going to call them gods or differentiate them or analyze them or pour inspiration out to them or be inspired by them and all the activity that goes on between humans and these principles? And beginning, if you take it back, beginning the first without whom none other can exist is the principle of isolate intelligence. And historically, we see that elsewhere, as I use the Zoroastrian or example, a man who came to the same conclusion as Dr. Aquino comes to, that there is a figure of isolated intelligence who creates all the other gods. And in the Germanic tradition, that's Odin, the All-Father. That's why he's called that.
Mm-hmm. You spoke earlier of witnessing the supplementation of the star by the moon by the when the early winter seeds that prepared you to hear the word. Mm-hmm. Are there other connections that you see with the study of the night sky in pursuit of rain?
Well, sure. The night sky becomes a gate, right, and not a barrier. We're all familiar with that concept. Okay. Huh? So I read that somewhere. Everyone, I hope, or I guess people living in cities might look up at the sky now and say, what's the big deal that night? And I can't see a thing. But if you're in otherwise, normally you look up into the night sky and you cannot be a child or adult. If you open yourself, you're honest, not just, oh, stars, who cares? That it is a gateway to mystery, to the unknown. It's just that with this phenomenon, as I said, no one could ignore it. No one could make it ordinary. Some explained it as atomic bombs on the moon, or explosions, or invasions from Mars, or whatever. Others just, oh, that's what it was, Venus doing this thing. But no one could fail to be impressed by what they saw. And also the miraculousness of this. You realize, to really get this, sometimes you'll get this, and I've never seen it since. Has anybody ever seen this phenomenon in their actual lives? No. Because you see how miraculous it is that this moon in a crescent form, that one point, how many infinite numbers of points are there in the night sky? And that this planet also intersects with that exact point almost infinitely, an almost infinite number of possibilities until that particular thing happens. So even if you look at it just mathematically, so this is a virtual miracle. And so you can't fail to be impressed by that, although any observation of the night sky, I think, can have this effect on a person if it takes its true and good course in a person's mind. If you look at it for what it actually is, it's miraculous, it's impactful enough. Anybody else? Yes.
I'm curious about the time when you wrote about your distinction between reintegration and making a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still a difference?
Sure. Well, not only reintegrate, but the fact that a true Setian, as I understand it, is fine, that there's the separation from, as the seal or the pentagram of Set shows, and I think that, I got into the temple 1984, and was the thing that was heavily emphasized in the philosophy at that time, the separation between man, principle of isolated intelligence, a being gifted with the gift of Set, and the world of nature. And I think, as in recent correspondence, Dr. Kim said, Setian philosophy is like just trajectory. It's changing, doing things. And the work of Mega Aquino has the way philosophy is that kind of thinking, that the idea of the connection with nature is something that at that time, 1984, is just simply not addressed. So this is why her work is so significant, a real work which impacts the philosophy without changing its principles, but expanding its scope to take in more understanding. However, The idea of the contra templum idea, which I say, if Runa is Kefir, then why Runa? Like anywhere, it should distinguish itself, not just be that again. Okay, if it's different, how is it different? And it's not so much that the idea of the separation of nation, the reintegration that you're talking about, as the idea that you all experience, and it's the strength of the temple, that you each individually will have your own individual authentic path of initiation, which is particular to each one of you individually. Whereas Runa has this dimension where it says, what about culture? What about tradition? How will what will bond, what will cause, or what in the philosophy binds the individual initiate into a model which says, I cannot abandon this philosophy. I am obligated in a metaphysical or a fundamental eternal way to other people and to something which is a, just use the word tradition. And I think that that's the nature of Sedian philosophy, is that there is none. So that, you know, you say, well, why if someone says, I'm really into Odin right at the moment there. And so then I say, well, okay, you do this work and that. And I say, well, Dr. Flowers, I decided to worship Cthulhu now. And from the, from a Sedian perspective, okay, I can't say, you idiot. What do you want to worship a science fiction god for? You know, because that's as even I created this document, the Spectrum of the Trapezoid. So there's a place in Sedian philosophy that is okay. I mean, neo-mythology, you can create your own mythology. There's nothing delegitimizing that. Because if you are a powerful initiate and you have created this coherence in isolation from tradition, and you've created something unique and unto yourself, that's the way it's supposed to work. It's not that it's working badly or wrongly, etc. It's just working differently. And Runa is something which is very much connected, again, in all of its manifestations, to something that says, because, again, going back to the question of the seal of Runa, that's where it comes. It's like, if you look at a man's philosophy, say, Michael Aquino, look at that seal of Set, of the pentagram, and you look at that. You say, I can understand the man's philosophy from that picture. And I say, this is just, and the seal of Runa is just my response to him through his influence, through the Sedian influence. Say, he says this, and I say, not in a sense contra, in a sense additional, or in some way other than, but that's my job. I'm a fifth degree, I'm doing my job. Okay. But there's the difference. So if you just look at those two pictures, but then you see them together, you see them separately, they work together, but they are different. Again, otherwise, so why bother? You know, just say, what he said. And I have just temple philosophy in general, I always say the temple is founded, and most of people, I wasn't even around in that certain times when problems arose, connected to philosophy in the past of the temple, that temple is founded on the word Kefir. And it must always, otherwise, if it's founded or it's on anything else, it won't be the temple. It's got, that's a coherent, that's it. I mean, that is, it can create other words. It's becoming. But another word, if you insert it, say, okay, like if I brought Runa to the temple in a direct kind of way, as another word was brought to it and said, now we're working on a different premise. It causes problems. You know, and you just got like 9 people left at the end of the battle, you know, something like that. So Aruna would have done the same thing to the temple if it had said, now we're going to operate on that principle or any other. So that's what it's founded on. That's my belief anyway, just my word to the wise that way, as far as this whole idea that it's a word should be the process or the end of a process for certain people who can't do any other, can't operate any other way. It just manifests itself. But that, in my document Contra Templum, which literally means against the temple, it's just a response to the temple, and that's all. And that's the nature of it. But I think you can sum it up in those two. If you just looked at it, said, okay, I'm into pictures, you know, I just want to draw me a picture, man, what you're talking about. I'm confused. You just look at the seal of Seth, the seal of Runa, and you could talk about it all day long and understand what's going on. Okay. Anybody else? Oh, it's Paul.
You had mentioned a word earlier, I think, in connection with Runa.
Uh-huh.
I think it was Mysterion.
Mysterion, yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about that? What is the origins of that word? How does that relate to Aeonica?
Well, when I started exploring other meanings of, okay, Runa, mystery, etc., and that's sort of the generation of, like, the book Hermetic Magic that I wrote on in the kind of the Greek idiom, etc. And then I did this other one on Ogham. It's like, okay, it's like, if I apply the method of Runa to these other traditions, will it work? In other words, is it just unique to this tradition only working here, or can I apply the same methods and the same idea, etc., to another one and have it not just say, okay, I can cobble together some words about Mysterion and things like that, but can I actually discover something new about it? And I think that book, Hermetic Magic, showed that. So that's why our word mystery is just the Greek word for the unknown, and it's something into which someone is initiated, that's the whole mystery cults and things like that of Greek antiquity. And so this is the word that we understand, but again, it is not doesn't mean a closed secret, but rather in a sense that people are keeping it from you, except insofar as there might be a teaching that they're not going to let you into until you've undergone the initiation, but that it is something which is a divine mystery. So, and the words are, you know, like in the Gothic Bible is translated by Ulf Ilesbek in the 400s. When the Greek word mysterion came up, he just translated it with rune. So it was the runes of the kingdom of God. But there it just means mystery, not letter at all. It just means this is being used just as a mystery. So.
A comment and a question. My comment is, if you're sitting in a room with hybrid from Kepler, Luna, and Manifest of Arte, it's somewhat ominous to me. I think it's a prison. It's something that have that in the same room. My question for you is, touched on it slightly when you were answering the question in the previous question. I've always viewed initiation to be somewhat of a cyclical nature, where one, as Kepler, if we manifest as a result of it, then always has that constant pull to see the mysteries that pulls one towards the next act of Kepler. And I've spoken about that in several occasions, and people have, on other occasions, asked me, well, which one comes first? don't have an answer for that. And I'm curious, A, whether or not the answer is of any concern, but B, kind of what your thoughts on...
I would concur in that our use of those three words, those particular three words together and how they work together is, I would concur in your analysis there. And also say that, well, that's the kind of thing which I think is mysterious. And we could talk about it or you could speculate on it, but you could have three people in the room and they could all come up and say, well, it started with a remanifestation. For me, it was if they really understood the words, they could, I think, come up with three different answers for them, you know? That in other words, there wouldn't be an empirical answer. Well, this is how it starts, because then what is it? What happens? Then I have to say, well, this guy said it begins with Runa, because we get this sense of this, etc. But is that only just when it becomes conscious, when you first are stimulated, etc.? But if someone came up with an answer or dogmatically asserted this was the answer, then every honest initiate would be put into position of just saying, well, I have to just believe what this guy said, right? I'll just believe it because I choose to believe it, or I'll believe it contrary to my own experience, or I will say I believe it so I don't get drug off to a gulag somewhere if I don't say the right answer that's currently prevalent or whatever. But I think with something is, because all of these words, to me, that they're all mysterious and all, if you are at all aware of them, then they are awesome. They're all awe-inspiring. And I don't think can be put into convenient sort of cubby holes and say, well, this is doing this and nothing else. You know, and to what extent do all of these, I think that's part of the historical understanding of these aeonic words. If we go back to the origin of the whole philosophy, this idea of aeons and how they work together, that there's a lot of them, and they're interacting all the time, like a living organism. And say, well, it starts here, and as I've written in Runarmal, it's like that Kefir is sort of the word of words that it exists within, because there's this sort of idea of the becoming between and among all of these levels of being and such, but that Runa stands outside of that. So that you're seeing it, it's on the horizon always. You know, like, oh, what's that? You know, but it's not here, it's there. But as I move across space, I'm traversing things I wouldn't normally traverse. I'm just sitting here going, I'm comfy here. I'm not going anywhere. I'll just stay here. Everything seems provided. I have no reason to go over there. What? You see that over there? Oh, I don't see anything. You know? Well, I'm curious. I want to go look and find out what's over there. And so but then we start going and we start becoming and that sort of thing. So I don't think you can. I think you can say one thing or another, but I think it would be philosophically dishonest to me and violate kind of a runic principle to say, I know. Oh, man, I know. I know where it starts. I know where it ends. See? So ask Ipsissimus Lewis, you might have a different answer. I mean, or Dr. Queenery might have a different answer. But Runa says, as Ipsissimus Webb says one time, Runa says, who knows? But you have to know. You can know. I mean, you can know enough, well enough to say, for me, this is what's going on, and I will operate on that principle, and if it works for me, then I'm going to stick with it.
You've been listening to KHPR, The Voice of Darkness. If you have any questions or comments, you can email them to us at khpr@keffer.org. Thank you for listening, and we hope that we've been able to bring about some change for you.